Welcome to Sounds of the Bizarre Live Internet Radio, live from Online Educa 2014 in Berlin, the capital of Germany. And it's about the fifth time, I think, that we've broadcast live from Online Educa. It's always a pleasure. We've got two shows set out for you. From now, we're broadcasting live till 12 o'clock midday CET, and we'll be back again at 11:15 tomorrow to bring you all the best of Online Educa. And we've got a bit of innovation this year. For those of you who know Online Educa, there's a bar called the Marlene Bar, and there used to be a big golden bear, and we used to broadcast from by that bear. But this year, they've set us up a studio. Yes, it's not a big studio, but we've got a beautiful-looking studio and newsroom. We've got purple seats to match our almost purple poster, and we've got a sofa. And Jen and Helen Keegan are on the sofa, and they're going to be doing the first interview today. So over to you, Jen and Helen, on the sofa.
Thanks, Graham. Helen, a very old friend, but always bursting with new ideas. So you've just arrived here, absolutely buzzing from the opening session. So what was grabbing you this morning?
Okay, I think the three really superb keynotes. So it's great to set the tone for the conference. Firstly, we had Howard Rheingold, whose contribution to our understanding of the web and learning, I think, can never be overestimated. And to hear him talk about his journey from the early, early days and through to his current practice in co-learning, it's just incredibly inspiring. And I think he really reminds us what's important, you know, and it wasn't really about, you know, the systems or the platforms or the vendors. It was really about the learners and about using the web for good. And that's incredibly important. So I think that was a great message to kind of kick things off with. And then actually we've just closed with Mark Stevenson, who was hilarious, terrifying glimpses into the future, but because I'm old, apparently the kids aren't so scared. But no, that was really, really excellent set of keynotes. So yeah.
What did he say about the future then? God, just tell me one or two things because I missed it.
It's tiny. No. Yeah, just talking about, well, basically the, you know, stuff that I guess we do kind of know, which is, you know, we often educate into redundancy because we educate into the current world as opposed to the future. But I think because of Mark's, you know, expertise in essentially the future, he really did make a compelling case for the irrelevance of many of our current practices.
That makes me feel really old. So you've got your presentation this afternoon, which has got a mysteriously intriguing title because it's all about mystery and intrigue in e-learning. Are you allowed to give us a preview?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I should just use that as a stock title, shouldn't I, for every presentation I do, because people love it. It's mystery, it's intrigue, and then I could talk about anything. Essentially, I'm going to be talking about a time when I ran a module as an alternate reality game, basically lied to learners, tricked them into learning, made them kind of scared, paranoid, and all these awful things that we shouldn't do, and by God, was it effective. So that's what I'll be talking about today.
I don't want to talk about the ethics of doing that then.
Oh, how long have you got?
Tell us about the game, because obviously that's something that you had just started last year and you were really keen to get going on it.
You know, it's actually 3 years ago now. That's how much time flies, yeah. And I'm still talking about it. So people like it, you know. But it was very much tying into some of the ideas that Howard and Mark put across today in terms of what kind of learning behaviours do we want our learners to demonstrate, you know, and the importance of not so much seeking the answers that we already know, but really asking good questions. And that's what I'm really focused on. And obviously with, you know, the sort of educational logic within which we operate, aims, objectives, outcomes, etc., we're always testing people on the known. And I wanted to see how far people would go when they didn't know what the hell was going on. And it was really, really effective. So, yeah.
Okay. So what are you working on next, Helen? Where do you go from here?
Oh, my word. I'm kind of working on lots of things. I've been working on international mobile filmmaking collaborations for quite a few years now. That's really exciting stuff. So recently we had 120 students from Colombia, New Zealand, the UK and France create the visual backdrop for an eight-act opera that was premiered in London in summer. And it was entirely filmed and edited using mobile devices in international teams. That was pretty awesome. Just coming to the end of the Connected Courses MOOC, and I'm part of the team behind that with people like Howard Rheingold and Mike Wesch and Mimi Ito. So that's been really interesting, and I'm looking forward to seeing where that kind of takes us next as well.
Helen, thank you very much indeed. I'm sure we'll meet up later. I'm hoping to come to your session.
Thank you.
Well, I think now we have a musical break, if Dirk can organise that for us, while I go find our next guest.
Sounds of the Bazaar live. Live internet radio from Online Educa Berlin. Now, one of the interesting things with Online Educa is it's got a huge exhibition area. And running this radio show, we don't actually get a lot of time to go to the conference sessions. But what we do, though, is get plenty of time to wander around the exhibition, talk to exhibitors, and see what's going on. And I think from that you can get a fair idea of the trends within the trends going on within e-learning in general. Sometime in the course of this programme, in the course of tomorrow's programme, I'm going to be talking about what I think the trends are. But in the meanwhile, the next person is on the sofa. We've got Andrew Ravenscroft, and then we've got more fabulous guests lined up for you. Over to Jen on the purple sofa, Sounds of the Bazaar.
Hi, Andrew. He's just said it's nice on his sofa. I'm not sure about that. Shall I just wriggle up a bit? Okay. Andrew, this is kind of turning the tables, because this is internet radio asking you about your experiences of internet radio with kids.
Well, I don't know where to start, really, but the interesting connection was that a lot of the keynotes, I thought, were quite disappointing, if I'm honest, in the main, because they're talking about technological revolutions and how technology is going to change education. I think on the Radioactive project, we found out that what makes education work is making it matter to people in their own environments and about things that... And it's amazing how people... We've used internet radio as an educational intervention with young people, old people, learning disabled people. In every way, it has astonishing improvements, both in the skills they acquire, but more importantly, in their own confidence, self-efficacy. And in some ways, it gives things like hope where there is none. So today, the keynotes were talking about access being a technology issue. What about access of the mind? How do you actually connect with people's minds such that they can engage in meaningful learning experiences? And I've heard nothing about that today, apart from when Mark Stevenson, towards the end of his talk, started to talk about humanity, kindness. I would put love into the equation. If we understand one another better and work with communities, creating educational experiences that matter to people in the context where they feel comfortable, that's how we can include people in education, not necessarily by providing with some technological toolkit.
Can you tell us just very briefly about the Radioactive project that you started in London? I think it was 4 years ago now.
Yeah, I mean, the concept's very simple. So we're using internet radio, the whole space of radio, as an educational intervention. The point being that the sort of people, young people we work with, they wouldn't do a communication skills course or a music technology course or a sound engineering course. They certainly wouldn't do a journalism course and think about counter-narratives and radical positions and this sort of thing. But through making radio shows with a, you know, within a structure that's scaffolded, so people who are not so much experts, people like yourself, Jem, people like myself who can do radio, we facilitate the creation of radio programs that purely about things that matter to the young people that we're working with. And what's really startling is that they want to make dialogue-based programs. We thought they just want to DJ grime, sort of the fashions of their hood, as it were. But no, they've got lots of issues that they're really unhappy about, that they really want to go deeper into interviewing people, interviewing one another. So essentially, it's a very simple idea. It's saying there's all these people out there who are excluded from the education system. How can we get them into the system? Internet, the whole space of internet radio, is a really attractive catalyst. It gets them learning. It gets them confident in themselves. It gets them to develop communication skills and literacy skills that would be almost unimaginable without them doing the radio.
And that project, which started in London all those years ago, has in the last 2 years spread across Europe to Radioactive Europe. How many countries are involved now?
In terms of the consortium, there's now 6 partners involved. So we've got partners in the UK, Portugal, Wales. I'll treat Wales as an additional case, and Romania and Germany. But we're now, this is hot off the press, we're going to be forming the Radioactive Foundation going forward, because it's a unique project in the sense that everybody is completely motivated to sustain the project. All the excluded groups that are involved want to continue. So at the moment we've got a core of 6 European partners, but implicit in our sustainability approach is recruiting more European partners. So, for example, I've just been speaking to lots of friends here, sort of my friend Lena from a place called Gloria in Helsinki, who we're going to be visiting in the new year. And also, I'd like to, during the last month of the project, visit anybody I might meet here who thinks this is a half-decent idea. I will try and visit them or try and bring them in to the Radioactive family, because, you know, I've been working in this area for about 30 years, and I can say without a shadow of a doubt, this is the most worthwhile and effective project I've worked on.
And one last question, probably a hard one. If you had to think of one thing that you've learned personally over the last 4 years of doing internet radio, what would it be?
It'll have to be 2 things. The magic of radio. There's something about radio as a literacy rather than a broadcast medium that is quite magical from educational purposes, and I think, and also what links it, it's so important to understand, to get things like humanity, kindness, you know, genuinely the real human elements, you know, justice, social justice, you know, all those softer human elements into play. Without that, learning doesn't happen.
Andrew, that was brilliant. Thank you very much, and good luck on Radioactive in the future.
And it's back to Graham Atwell speaking here. And now we're going to try something completely new. We're going to do a quick switch over on the sofa. People running here is a wee bit crazy, but good fun. Thank you, Jenny, for joining us on the sofa today. And we're quickly talking before about what you might talk to us about. And we're going to talk about emerging technologies and how they're being used.
Okay, well, I want to tell you a bit about innovation in my new job, which is the University of Western Australia, which is quite a traditional, very beautiful university by the wonderful Swan River in Western Australia. And it's a very old university for Australia, a whole 100 years old already. But education is still really in the 20th century, so my role is to help the university to look forward to use emerging technologies for the whole of its educational. And I think that's something almost everyone in every institution, regardless of level of education, is doing throughout the world at the moment.
Are you sure about that? I mean, everybody, especially people who are in the lead in this, say that is happening. But I see huge areas where I am not so convinced.
Everyone wants to do it, but not everybody's certain how to. I would think that you would have to really have your head in the sand not to believe that you didn't have to transform and change your teaching. But everyone's struggling, and most people are still going around working out how to do it. So in a minute, I'm going to give you the absolute clue.
Okay. tell me the obstacles and what you think, where you think the obstacles are. You said some people are struggling to do it. Then tell me the golden answer.
Well, the golden answer I'll start with first. Innovators never answer the question, you know that. So the answer is to design the future rather than try and respond to everything that's happening. We know that the future has to be created. You can't predict it. And if we can't in universities be the ones doing the creating, then I ask you, somebody else will. So we need to see it as a complex adaptive system, and we need to be extremely creative in our design. So I'm focusing and working across the institution with academics, with information specialists, with learning technologists, and frankly, anybody else, including the students, who's willing to give us the time of day. And we're working through a complex design process that actually only takes 2 days to change our teaching.
And what do you mean when you're talking change complex design processes, which only takes 2 days, so are they that complex? But how does the teaching change?
The teaching changes by using an integrated approach to teaching. So we start with the learning outcomes we're hoping to achieve, which means that the professors still maintain their ownership of the knowledge and their understanding of how they want the students to learn. But the way we do this, we work through a storyboard. It's really purely based on the idea of storyboarding, you know, a la Disney and everyone else who's come since, a very visual and collaborative approach. And we recognize that we start with the end in mind, in other words, in this case, learning outcomes and assessment. And then we move to working out how we do it. And surprise, surprise, by the end of the 2 days, there are no more lectures left on the storyboard.
So, the end of lectures, the end of diplomas next, possibly?
Possibly. I haven't seen that happen yet, but there's definitely a lot of flipping going on. And many of the people who take part in this recognise that they are going to have to teach in a different way from the way they themselves have learnt.
Julie, I'd love to keep talking to you for the next half hour on this, because it's very interesting, and I've got my own ideas I'm going to keep very quiet about. But we've got a queue of people waiting to join us on the sofa here. Thanks very much. And over to Dirk for a musical break on Sounds of the Bazaar, live from Online Educa.
I'm sitting here talking to Eric Roussel, who's going to talk to us about open badges. Now, a lot of people at this conference are going to know about open badges, but there's going to be a whole lot who don't, and certainly there are going to be people listening out there. Eric, can you just explain the concept, the principle of open badges and how they work?
Okay, thank you. I will try. Well, basically, open badges is a standard which has been developed by Mozilla Foundation 3 years ago for recognizing things you learn everywhere. So there is a lot of things about recognizing of informal learning. But of course, badges can be used also in education or vocational education and even in companies. Basically, if you think as badges as a physical representation, it's a digital badge. So it's a picture which contains metadata. And the metadata will tell you about the skills, knowledge and achievement of the learner. And so we could say that open badges are validated proof of learning, basically.
That's a really clear explanation. But can you give me an example? How do I get a badge? What can I get a badge for?
Okay. So you get a badge. A badge is always issued by some, what we call some issuer. Issuer can be a peer, can be an organization, and this organization will recognize the things you learn. So it can be your employer, it can be a university, it can be a school teacher, and so on. And then the badge will be baked. We speak about baking. This metadata will be added in the badge and sent to you mostly by email. And then when you click the badge, you will receive it in the backpack. In the backpack, it's the Mozilla backpack. It's a place where you can receive your badges and display your badges.
So this backpack, it's an online backpack. I mean, can other people see it, or is that just something that I can look at?
The backpack, it's basically a free open repository in the internet where you can store your badges. But the backpack has been a bit tricky to be used, and receiving a badge, according to our experience, has not been always very easy. So now there is a lot of initiative to develop what you call Open Badge Passport, which will be also kind of micro portfolio where you can store your badges and add some other evidences about your learning.
So what do you actually do? What does your organization do in this world of badges?
Our organization is what we could say a company which provides learning services, e-learning services, platforms, and so on. So our role with Open Badges is to develop what we call Open Badge Factory, which is a cloud system where organizations can easily create the badges, issue the badges, and manage the badges. Because there is, at this moment, there is a big demand on badges in universities, in companies, but there is also a very big need of management. People don't want to issue poor badges. They don't want to lead to badge inflation, and they don't want to have a kind of fragmentation of the badges in many systems. So we try to provide a good platform when you can really build a consistent badge system, quality badge system.
And one of the things that rings alarm bells here, if people are now trying to introduce quite rigid quality control systems into badges and to standardize badges and to stop kind of badge inflation, how near is that to moving badges back into a formal assessment and education system? I mean, what started off as a really wild idea to accredit informal learning, is it now becoming itself formalized?
Well, let's say that when we're speaking about badge strategies, there are different kind of approaches. You have clearly, for example, organization wants to validate learning, informal learning, and are starting to use badges a bit like certificates. But badges are much more than certificates. They tell about the contents. They are proof of learning. They can display the thing that you really know. So, in my opinion, it's always a risk to use badges as certificates. It's a poor way to use badges, but in one way, it's an easy way to start with badges. So, there is no. I would say that it's okay, but we should keep in mind that badges are much more than certificates. But what's now is interesting that universities and schools now are interesting to use badges to show the thing that students really learn and know. And for employers, it's a very good thing, that because with certificate you don't really know what the young people coming to your company really know. But with badges, you could have the proof that, okay, this guy can really code with Java, because he can show the badge and he can show the code in the badge.
Excellent. And how young are the children that can actually use your badges? Because I work mainly with primary school teachers, primary school children. Is that too young for your badges?
No, I think that small kids, of course, can use badges. I think it's it should be fun. We in academic world we always speak about badges as a representation of learning. There is a standard and so on. But badges are a way to motivate people. And I think that for young kids can get already badges from games. And I think it's a very good way to motivate young kids to learn, but also not so young kids, also adults. And badges are also for adults. But then you can call them open credits if you don't like the word badges.
Thank you very much, Eric. Hope to see you next year. You get your radio badge, no problem. I'll issue it after the program.
I will issue the badge. Thank you very much.
Merci.
This is Sounds of the Bazaar live from Online Educa Berlin. And this is turning into a fabulous program. Earlier on, we were, is anybody going to turn up? Have we got too many people? But it's all beginning to rock and roll now. And just in front of me, there's a vast group of people wearing blue T-shirts. And on their back, they say Video Educa. So this is going to be Radio Educa talking to Video Educa. Jen, let's find out what they're doing.
I have no idea what you're doing, other than you walking around this place with cameras and blue T-shirts. Who wants to start off? Just tell me who you are, where you're from.
Yeah, we're from Berlin here. So.
We're students and we're having a little project right here, and we first took a look at all the location and figured out where is everything, so that we're later making films about everything and filming different perspectives and different styles for the camera moving around and people walking around. So what
so what are you hoping to produce at the end of it? Is it one film, or does everybody make their own films?
I understand that we make one film together, and we make it in groups that all film different, that we can do it faster. Yeah. And we have a lot of creative ideas.
So are you all from the same school or the same college or the same organization?
Yeah, we are from the same school called OSZ Kim. It's a school for media technology. So yeah, that's where we're from.
What have you learned so far about the conference then?
What
have you learned so far? You've been here, I saw some of you yesterday. You've been here this morning. What have you actually been doing this morning? What have you learned so far?
Alter. Was soll ich sagen, Alter?
Somebody want to tell me what you've been doing this morning?
We had a conference with a little talk about what we're doing for this film, what is important for this film, which shots we need, and what everybody thinks what is good for this film.
Okay, and are you here all afternoon and tomorrow as well?
Tomorrow, yeah, we're here also, yeah.
Yeah. We're editing.
I just figured out we're editing tomorrow. Yeah.
Okay. And today you're actually filming. What sort of things are you filming? Are you going into the sessions to film, or just filming people wandering around, or?
Different things. We want to film from the outside and the entrance. It's called the establishment. Yeah, that's what we want to do first, and also. Different words, and yeah, so people know where they are and what is happening right here.
That's kind of important, because you do the same on radio, because if you listen to Graham, what was the first thing you did?
What was the first thing I did when?
It was about setting the scene and establishing where we were.
Yes, tell people where you are, what's going on, what's happening, what it all looks around you. Because look, to someone watching on a video or someone listening on radio, it's even worse on radio. At least on video, you can put a videoscape of the whole sound. What I have to do is say we're standing here in a main hallway in Berlin. It's cold outside. There's hundreds of people around. And it's telling a story. So when there's someone listening to my sound or watching your video, then they can picture what the context is that you're coming from. And it's that storytelling which I think is the great thing about both radio and video media. I prefer radio. It's too difficult video myself.
Can I just say, I mean, really the purpose of the Youth Camera Team project is to create an alternative kind of video from probably what will be the official video. And of course we have some fantastic guys filming for the official video for the conference, but what these young guys are doing will be this conference from their perspective, and so they have creative free rein to kind of, you know, do it their way and how do they see it, without the agenda of, well, it's for a particular purpose of, you know, selling the idea of what the conference is officially, in a corporate sense, perhaps. So these guys are coming up with some really great creative ideas already this morning.
They're the ideas I really want to hear about. I want an advance, I want a preview of this video. That was Rachel, by the way. Rachel Tolley? Rebecca Tolley.
So I'm leading the group. Yeah.
Okay, go on, tell me what your impressions are then. Tell me what we're going to see on video. Come on.
Surprise.
Oh, that's not fair. I want to know what your impressions are already.
It's pretty big. And yeah, that's the impression.
Is e-technology something that you're used to using in school?
What kind of?
The e-technologies that are being demonstrated here. Do you use e-technology in school, or how do you use it?
The only thing we're using is electronic blackboards. What else do we use? Yeah, we have a school network so that you can share data from, for example, you made a Photoshop project, and so you can put it in a folder and everyone of this class can take this.
I'm going to ask you maybe a difficult question, but how far away from the reality in your school, in your classroom, is what's going on here? So these people are at the cutting edge of technology, they're exhibiting technologies, they're talking about technologies, but actually they're talking about education. Just how far away is it from what you know about in your schools?
No,
do you want to talk in German? Is that easier?
Huh?
Talk in German if that's easier.
No, I just wanted to say to him not to say that our PCs have Windows XP. And it is a little bit far away.
Sure, we have a lot of German listeners. If you want to answer in German, that's fine.
Yeah, but I think it's better to talk in English when you talk to me in English, then more people can understand what we're talking about, because on the station here, the most people speak English, and I think it's the better language.
Ooh.
I think we need to go now. One last question. Why is it all boys here?
We got a girl.
In that case, I'm going to ask you a question, because I looked around, and I couldn't actually see you because you're hiding at the back. But you are the only girl on this project, yeah?
Yeah. At our school, there are not so much girls. Yeah.
So what are you studying in school? What sort of school is it?
It's a media technology school. Yeah.
Audio video.
An audio video technology school?
I don't know. He can tell it.
We're learning about audio technology, video technology, and programming in general. And we're not so far away from stuff that is presented here, but our school is relatively open to new technologies. Nothing.
Do you want to come back next year and help us with the radio station?
No.
Really?
Video is more.
You want to do video? Yeah. Does anybody want to do radio? Do you want to come and help us next year? No takers. No takers.
I like doing both. I like doing radio and filmmaking. So, it's communication. That's what it's about. So, these guys, I think these guys, if you talk to these guys tomorrow afternoon, after they've been filming and after they've started the editing process, I think that they will have a, you know, they'll be able to talk a lot more about what they're doing, I think. So at the moment, we're just planning. So, but we're going to be filming this afternoon, so everybody will see us out and about and with cameras. And
well, this is an open invitation to come back tomorrow, because we're doing another program tomorrow, same time, same place. So if you'd like to come and join us and tell us what you've been doing, that would be brilliant. Thanks very much, guys.
And this is Sounds of the Bazaar, broadcasting live from online edge of Kerberlin, and we're bumping into all kinds of lovely people here, and I'm trying to keep an eye on what's going on. I think what we're going to do is we're going to have a short musical break now, and after that we're going to talk to ITN, International Television News.
Very exciting.
Welcome back to Sounds of the Bazaar, and I'm talking to Dan Mills here from ITN. We got really interested. We arrived at the conference yesterday, and as was our wont, we sat in the bar staring out at the world, drinking coffee and thinking, and then we saw ITN. It's a news channel from the UK, and we're wondering, what the hell is ITN doing at an e-learning conference? So we went and found Dan, who was on the stand, and said, what the hell is ITN doing at news conference? He said, good question, and I'll tell you tomorrow. Yeah. So here he is.
Yeah, thanks, Graham. We are the largest commercial news provider in the UK. So we get about 10 million views daily on TV. We also produce digital news for MSN, Yahoo, YouTube, etc. And we get about 70 million views per month on that. So we are a large news organization, and as a byproduct of producing all that news for 60 years, we've amassed this huge archive of video content, and we've actually been working in education now for about 14 years, so we're not new to the education space. We have been part of a long sort of standing relationship with Discovery Education, or formerly Espresso Education, where we've been providing content that's been adapted for a younger audience. So while it may make news for 10 o'clock that evening, the same content can be used to send a different message or a much simpler message to children. So one of the points I'm making tomorrow in the Video Educa conference is how current affairs and other news content can be used to teach physics, social sciences, language, history, and all manner of different subjects covering all different years. So in our archives we have about 3 million digitized clips that are viewable, downloadable and searchable to cover, you know, the last 120 years of history. So yes, we're a news company, but we're also a massive digital content company. And as the growth in video online and video in education is apparent, we think we're pretty well placed to service that market. So.
Well, I think looking around this conference, there's no doubts that video is big. But I suppose the other big issue is two issues, isn't there? One is access to video, and you've got a massive archive of many riches, I would imagine. But how can people access that? And then second to accessing it, just getting hold of it, there's the whole remix issue, or can you give access to people in a forum where they can remix themselves. So we're going far more towards the peer production using video than just the old relationship where there was professionals with very expensive machines. Notwithstanding that, your archives are unique almost.
Yeah, so that's a good question. We've spent millions in digitizing and cataloging and tagging particular metadata to our clips. We've 3 million clips published on our site at the moment. We also publish content on YouTube. We share our content. We license our content to publishers who then may repackage it and adapt it for different uses. But all of our content is searchable on our website, itnsource.com. It's much, much cheaper, in some cases free, to access content, archive content, than to produce it yourself. So if you were going to go and film something, particularly if we're talking about, you'll see some of the images that we have on our stand, you know, Martin Luther King, Winston Churchill, particular sort of political events, you know, Vietnam.
And I saw yesterday the Sex Pistols, which I thought was even better.
Yeah, I mean, there's something for everyone there, I guess. So, I mean, you can't recreate those scenes, images, and you know, iconic moments. So, in some cases, you have to go back to archive, and blend it with, you know, your own content as well. So that's, you know, that's something that we can do.
Well, thank you very much for explaining to us. I'm going to come along later and actually have a look at your archive, because I'm way interested in using it. But thank you for coming and talking to us today.
Cheers. Thanks very much. Okay.
And we're overrunning, as is our want at Online Educo, but there's just so many people to talk to. And I'm handing over to Jen now, who's back on the sofa.
I'm talking to Jeff Stace. Is that how you pronounce your name? That's the first thing.
It's Jeff, yeah. That's okay. Yep.
Good. It's my fluent Dutch. The reason I've got Jeff here is because I was really intrigued by his session yesterday, which was called The Diploma is Dead. And I thought, I do love a good anarchist on this program. So, Jeff, tell us what's all this about.
Well, you have to know I've been working in industry for 23 years. I've been a trainee manager and corporate learning officer. And I remember that 15 years ago, we hired people based on their diploma. Like, you have a university degree, you have good points, you had good grades. And then we said, well, hire this guy because he has a discipline to learn. And if you have the discipline to learn, you can do every function that is offered to you. So we hire people with a university degree, basically because they have the discipline to learn. Now, what I noticed lately was that we kept doing the same stuff, but we noticed that a lot of people with university degree, after a half year of working, especially in telecommunications, they became incompetent. And the reason was is you don't need to have the discipline to learn, you have to have the passion for your talents to learn. And that's completely different. So, and then I start thinking about, how come? And then I start thinking about, how do you get a university degree? And what I always say is, you don't get a degree based on your passion and talents, but you get a degree because you passed courses you didn't have the passion and talents for. So at the end, you have somebody with a degree who has proven who is less smart than the teacher and has proven that he's able to study stuff without passion and talents. And I think that's the reason why people have to learn so long. Now, I was thinking about that and I said, why can't we create an educational system where people can learn what their passion for their talents is? And if we could do that, then you don't need a degree. You just need a learning environment where people can select courses from their passion and talents and then learn very fast. So, and they can put together their own playlist of competences based on courses they learn. So at the end, you have very, very clever people, but in the groove with their talents. And that's what I call a competence playlist. So I said, if we reform education, so students can select courses with their passion and talents, they will start learning much faster. They will use social media, co-learning, whatever. This means that you could have a heart surgeon at the age of 19, because he's going to select the courses you need for heart surgery. And when I was thinking about that, then I came to the conclusion that by defending diplomas and higher education, we are just killing the passion and talents of students. And what is worse is that we get a lot of generations with a degree, and then they start working, and they mostly start working in an environment that changes very fast. But because they have a degree not based on their passion and talents, they can't keep up. So what I see now is that a lot of people with university degrees are becoming incompetent.
One question, because you're talking about heart surgeons, which was actually one of the vocations that was kind of going through my head, was medicine. Supposing you've got somebody who wants to be a doctor, and they go, well, actually, I don't want to do this, I don't want to do that bit, I don't want to do that bit because I'm not interested in it. Do we end up with a whole team of doctors who only know about somebody's big toe or something because they're not interested in the rest of them?
Well, I think that's true, but I think that is happening right now also. If you're looking, for instance, to dentists, you don't find any dentists anymore who can do everything. You see dentists who are specialized in certain things. And so what we are facing now is and that's a dilemma, we are facing a world where people have to be specialized very hard, because otherwise they can't keep up what is happening in their world. So what I see is that you don't have a heart surgeon anymore. You have a team of people doing a heart operation. And then you have to have very competent, talented people in your team specialized in what they are doing. Now, if you put this question this way, we have to think of education a completely different way, because education was built in a period of information shortage. This means that then we created schools, and we created schools with the technology of then, which means a teacher, handbooks, and a blackboard. And since we had information shortage, the only place to learn was school. So that's the reason why we said you have to have a degree, because if you don't get a degree, once you come from school, you can't learn anymore. And that's true when you have information shortage, that's true. But today we are living in an information luxury. And this means that you really don't have to go to school. Now imagine that as a kid or a teenager, you specialized in a certain thing that's needed for heart surgery. And then you get passion and talents for something else in heart surgery. Well, you can keep learning. And the case I'm making is that we really should stop thinking about generating a machine for diplomas, but generating an educational environment where people with passion and talents can join, do co-learning with everybody on the world, with people with the same passion and talents. And this is a dilemma, because the reason why it's going so slowly, it's not because it's possible. It's possible. And I see that a lot of companies are hiring not anymore on basis of diploma, but on basis of passion and talents. But the reason why it's so hard to change is because there's a lot of power with people who don't understand. So if you are a teacher today with 23 years of experience and you have a level of management, you don't want to change the system, because if you change the system, then you don't have the knowledge anymore in this new system. It's like the same thing that happens with the movie. And the silent movie, you had all these actors who were very specialized in silent actors. And then you had the speaking movie. So suddenly the speaking movie or talkies was possible. The reason why it took so long is we had so much resistance from the silent actors. And it was not because it was not possible. It was just because the lobby of power was so big that you couldn't advance fast enough. And this is happening again. There is so much possibilities in creating a new kind of education that I always wonder, how come it isn't done? It's not because it's not possible. Because just the power of the people who can't understand is so big that they can't change. But the same thing is in organizations. You have managers who can't work with people who are smarter than they are. It's the same kind of resistance. So again, you have to get rid of diplomas, and then that opens up a whole new world of learning, and that opens up a whole new world of getting to work. And it's just like, I wonder why it doesn't happen.
Is it something about being able to demonstrate proof of competence? I mean, without diplomas, and I'm certainly not supporting them, but how do I demonstrate to an employer that I can actually perform heart surgery?
Well, it's a tricky one, because it's a tricky one, because what I see now is that, and this is something I call social validation, and social validation is happening with social media. If you're very good as a journalist, people start talking about you. She's really good. She asks the right question at the right moment. She uses technology. And then you get value because people are going to search your presence on the internet. If you're not present on the internet, this means that nobody knows you. And if you're not present on the internet, that this means that you don't use internet as a learning environment. So what I think is we're going to a period where people get validated by social validation. But social validation will happen by peers and colleagues and customers, but will also happen with experts. So yeah, so I think it's we are going to see a rebirth of what we call used to call the guilds. So we have a guilds of surgeons which are very, very competent, and they're going to do social validation on peers. And this is an ongoing story. So instead of giving a degree or diploma at the age of 23, it's going to be, what is your value at this moment in time? And it's proved by colleagues who are smarter than you are and telling other people, he's the best guy I know.
Jeff, thank you very much. That's a really interesting take on where we're going in education. And I hope you're right, actually. Back to Graham now, because I think we've come to the end. I don't have a watch on today, is quite bad. But Graham,
I think we've overrun, and that last interview was very long, but I loved the interview. In fact, I've just said to Derek, our techie, let's cut that interview up as a podcast and put that out separate, because I think that's wonderful stuff. Okay, thanks for staying with us. This has been Sounds of the Bazaar broadcasting live from Online Educa Berlin, the first of two programs. We'll be back tomorrow at 11:15 for a second fabulous show from Online Educa Berlin. This is Graham Atwell. Thanks to Jenny. Thanks to Dirk. Thanks to Artemis for all your help to doing today's show. This is Graham Atwell signing out from Sounds of the Bazaar live. We'll be right back.